You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
What I'm going to do is take us through what happened in New Zealand last week and present a little of the background of those events. I'm going to assume that most of you folks know a certain amount of the background, and if you don't, then the PowerPoint slides, which are on your tables, will explain some of the details, which I will not go into at great length in the presentation. Last week, the NSG, representing virtually all of the nuclear supplier states in the world, held what was a routine meeting. It's an annual meeting where they have 3 days of consultations followed by 2 days of a plenary meeting. And that terminated on Friday, the 25th. For our purposes this morning, there were 2 points that were discussed during that conclave that were of interest. One of them was an agenda item. The agenda item was a discussion to try to get closure in negotiations on new guidelines concerning export controls for the transfer of sensitive information, equipment, technology related to reprocessing and uranium enrichment. And the other item, which was not on the agenda, was information that the NSG parties had concerning possible export by China of 2 power reactors to Pakistan. The background of this is that 1 month ago, 189 countries in the NPT agreed to a consensus final document at the RevCon in New York. And that was not without impact on this NSG meeting because of 2 things. One, the NPT parties concluded in its final document that for now, at least, the additional protocol is not considered to be a safeguards obligation for NPT parties. The other thing that happened in the export control area is that, to the surprise of some people during that negotiation in New York, the parties concluded by reaffirming principle paragraph 12 of the principles and objectives for nonproliferation and disarmament, which were agreed to when the NPT was extended in 1995. Most of you probably know this already, but it basically means that for non-nuclear weapon states, a condition of supply is that they have comprehensive IAEA safeguards agreement in place. Now, the discussion of enrichment and reprocessing, or so-called ENR guidelines, for those of you without detailed background, this has been under discussion in the NSG since about 2004, when President Bush proposed a ban on the spread of this technology to states which do not already possess it. The U.S. continued in that mode to try to ban the technology for technology transfers to new states until 2008, when they joined it. Then the U.S. weighed in the negotiations over how this would play out, just got into a discussion about the shape of the guidelines, the criteria that would be acceptable. Between 2008 and now, we've seen a number of objections that have been raised about these conditions, or 2 specific conditions, by a number of countries. Most of these objections have receded, and there has been a certain amount of impatience on the part of the United States and a few other leading countries in the NSG that there's no agreement on this. You got 46 countries. The NSG requires a consensus agreement for any new guidelines to be agreed upon. That 46 countries. It's a difficult proposition. Basically, various parties in the NSG have referred to it sometimes as a whack-a-mole, or sometimes like herding cats. You've got, you know, 46 countries. Each of them have their own issues, their own agendas, their own plans for the nuclear program, their own access to technologies, their own suite of technologies that they want to pursue. So it's been a difficult process. The fact that the NPT review conference, as I said, resulted in a final document where there was a considerable amount of agreement and harmony between states that want to see more technology transfer and states that have the technology and want to see that technology protected, that led to some optimists in advance of the meeting predicting that there would be an agreement on this issue. They turned out to be wrong. Two countries which were in the forefront of the objections in recent years, South Africa and Turkey, in fact, did play a major role during the meeting. South Africa, in the last several years, and also in other fora, including the NPT meeting, has objected to the efforts of advanced states to require the additional protocol as a condition of supply for any nuclear trade, and particularly in the NSG context for ENR. South Africa, during the meeting in New Zealand, pressed that issue again, but it looked as if in the last several days of the meeting that there was going to be some movement there. Basically, what happened is that the negotiators in New Zealand ran out of time, and they were not able to get clarification from the government in South Africa about the final position of the South African government. The suggestion has been that, you know, personality politics and individual people that are in the South African government are playing a role in this, and that there's differences there that have to be ironed out. They did not resolve that by the end of the meeting, so that was tabled. What was not resolved in a far more dramatic fashion were objections that were raised or re-raised by Turkey, which in fact seemed to exacerbate the debate in the NSG over this whole issue. In 2008 and 2009, Turkey, a country which has nuclear energy aspirations, including to a certain extent at least in the fuel cycle for the future, in the past has objected to the subjectivity of certain guidelines which would basically allow technology-holding states to not to supply Turkey or other countries access to technology because of their geographical location in a region, and specifically here in the Middle East or on the periphery of the Middle East. Now, in New Zealand last week, Turkey re-raised those, but Turkey took a much harder line, and many people that I've talked to who know about what happened during those closed-door meetings basically said the Turks took it practically what some consider to be almost an ideological position against any further restrictions on technology transfers from technology holders to newcomer nuclear states. The Turkish position was very, very firm. It basically signaled to the NSG that they weren't going to make any progress there. Turkey objects specifically to restrictions which would mandate technology holders to enter into new partnerships with newcomer states on the basis of a black box model in enrichment and reprocessing, meaning essentially that the technology holders would build a reprocessing plant or an enrichment plant in a newcomer state, but would not transfer the technology to that party. This is unacceptable to Turkey on grounds of principle. The suggestion has been made to me by some people close to that meeting that the Turkish government's position on nuclear energy, on its role in the region, the TRR deal that the Turks made with Brazil and Iran, perhaps The intermezzo that we saw in the Eastern Mediterranean a few weeks ago involving the Israeli raid, you know, these on a political level may have, you know, had an impact in the position that the Turkish government took during this meeting. We can only speculate as to whether that's really true. In any event, Turkey took a very hard-line position. And so now the NSG is before the dilemma of where are they going to go now? And the NSG put out a press release at the end of the meeting basically vowing that it would continue these negotiations. But, you know, I'm given to understand that some parties in the NSG don't feel that that would be a very productive way to go right now, that essentially Turkish position and their shot off the bow basically informs the NSG's technology holders that, you know, this is a non-starter. We're not going to do this. You're probably aware that in the run-up to the election of Yuki Amano as Director General of the IEA in 2009, a similar altercation took place between the NAM and advanced nuclear countries about the future of multilateral arrangements in the nuclear fuel cycle. And as a result, it looks as if the Director General will shelve that discussion of MLA for as long as 1 to 2 years because of concerns that the NAM have raised in principle against restrictions to technology transfer. And it seems to me that what was played out in Christchurch last week at the NSG was a kind of mini version of that problem. So we'll move on to the next issue that we want to talk about today, which is the non-agenda item of information concerning a possible export of power reactors by China to Pakistan. This is something that we at Carnegie have been following very closely for the last 2 months. I was in Beijing in March and got information directly from the Chinese company that's involved in this, that they had reached a final contract with Pakistan over the export of the reactors, that this was going to go ahead. We pursued this at Carnegie, and it came up on the NSG plate. It's not an agenda item, but the member states became seized of the issue. My understanding is that 10 countries of the 46 individually requested that the Chinese explain their intentions about this transaction. The Chinese complied with the request in the sense that they read a short statement saying that their current and future commerce would be in compliance with China's commitments to the NPT and perhaps significantly their commitments to the NSG. But the Chinese, to my knowledge, did not provide any specific information about whether or not they would go through with this transaction or not. And during the meeting, there was a discussion, including in the background with Chinese interlocutors, about whether or not there was a binding contract or not for this project. The Chinese, in my view, have basically four options. They can decide not to export the reactors. This appears at the moment to be the case. We don't know. The Chinese didn't tell anybody in the NSG as to when they would make a decision in a definite manner as whether this would go through or not. The other options are all connected to exporting. You know, the Chinese in the past when they joined NSG in 2004 claimed that the commerce that they had with Pakistan was grandfathered by a nuclear cooperation framework agreement predating China's entrance into the NSG in 2004, and that further commerce would be likewise grandfathered. Another option would be that they would, as the United States has urged them to do, to seek an exemption from NSG on the basis of the U.S.-Indian deal and what happened in 2008 when the NSG in the fall of 2008, acting on the request of the United States, supported by Russia and France, provided an exemption to India for full-blown nuclear commerce with the NSG. So the last option would be that because the guidelines are voluntary, the Chinese would have the right to exert their sovereign authority and say we're going to, for reasons that have to do with perhaps our national security and priorities that we have in the region, we're not going to follow the guideline. That's the other option. Should China export the reactors, at this point in time, it appears to me that there is no consensus inside NSG about how to proceed. As has become known through statements which the U.S. has made to the press in advance of the meeting, the United States government made clear in advance that they prefer that China seek an exemption on the basis of statements that the Chinese made back in 2004 that the Pakistan-Sino agreement for nuclear cooperation allowed China to grandfather a limited amount of commerce, but certainly not any more power reactors. That's the U.S. position. I'm informed it's supported by at least a few other states in the body. On the other hand, there are other states in the NSG who are wary of going that route. They would prefer that China present bona fides which would demonstrate that the commerce could be grandfathered. That would be the easiest solution. Some people have told me, you know, that would be the least damaging solution, because some of these countries that take this position were exposed to arm twisting by the U.S., by India, by France, by Russia in 2008 over the decision that the NSG had to take on the Indian deal. And having gone through that unpleasant experience in 2008, in 2010, they don't want to repeat that experience with China. There was also the concern among this group of states that should a deal be grandfathered, it wouldn't be credible, and it could provoke an unsettling reaction by the NPT parties who, as I said in the RevCon, made sure that the Indian deal was seen as an exception to the rules. So let's take a look at what's going on the ground. The Chinese officially have said nothing about this, neither to the NSG delegations behind closed doors, nor have they made any public statements saying that they will go through with this commerce. There's been a lot of, supporting and flanking information that's been coming across from unofficial people who speak sometimes for the Chinese government. Chinese government agencies, including the Foreign Ministry, have said that in their view, going through the commerce with Pakistan would be in line with China's agreements with the NSG and their commitments. As I said, in China in March, CNNC, China National Nuclear Corporation, which is the biggest state-owned enterprise in the nuclear area in China with a payroll of over 100,000 people. This company had reached a contract with the Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission for supply of nuclear steam supply system, turbine generators, and other equipment for two 320-megawatt PWRs to be built at Chasma next to two other reactors likewise supplied from China, and that China would provide soft loans to Pakistan to cover 80% of the cost of about $2 billion. That was the state of our information at that point. Since then, Chris Buckley at Reuters in Beijing has reported out that in addition to this, there are additional Chinese contracts which have been signed on or about the 8th of June for, quote-unquote, the installation of nuclear and conventional islands for both of the reactors. If you look on the website of the fifth construction company in China, you will find this picture, which, to my knowledge, witnesses the signing ceremony for that project in Pakistan. In the same website page, you will find this piece of information concerning the construction of Chasma 2, a reactor which China claimed was grandfathered under the NSG, or under their bilateral deal with Pakistan when they joined NSG in 2004. And this statement is very interesting because it indicates to us, of course, that, you know, the export of power reactors to Pakistan is not without its problems. Which brings me to the situation in Pakistan regarding the reactors and their electricity supply situation. In Pakistan, the electricity supply is becoming, in the view of many people in Pakistan, a national security issue. It's a country which is growing fast. The World Bank and the IMF attest to certain robust economic trends in the country. It's moving along in this sense in a very strong way. It is not anywhere near being described as a failed state or a failing state. Its economic entities are, to a very large extent, robust. They're exporting. They're producing wealth. But their electricity supply system is in very sad shape indeed, as this data indicates to us. They need more capacity. There's a shortfall. In 2008, it was at least 2,000 megawatts. Power demand growth is at 78%. The Pakistani companies, which are eager to do business and eager to attract new customers, are adding 1 million connections to the electrical grid in Pakistan per year. But significantly over about the last decade, there has been basically no real increase in generating capacity in Pakistan. So what we see happening is that the crisis continued to move along during the Musharraf period. Many people probably don't realize that in 2008, when the decision came leading to the removal of Musharraf, the electricity crisis in Pakistan was a major factor in that, in the electorate in Pakistan. Sure, the Pakistani voters and Pakistani citizens were concerned about the Taliban, but, you know, the bottom line for them was that Musharraf and his government were not delivering, making sure that people had electricity, and this was an issue during the election. Since 2008, the situation has deteriorated more. The load shedding in the Pakistani grid has continued to expand in scope. That's the background for, the contract which has been reached between the two parties. The question remains, however, is, on a deeper level as to whether or not Pakistan needs these reactors or whether they would even contribute in the near to medium term to an alleviation of their electricity supply problem. And the bottom line is that over the years, including, during the entire Musharraf period, there was no political will in Pakistan to raise electricity prices, as has been urged by many outside of Pakistan who are working with Pakistan to improve its electricity supply situation. Fossil fuels comprise about 65% of the total generation in Pakistan. As we know, since about 2006 and 2007, the price for these fuels has been skyrocketing. It's led to an enormous deficit in the electricity production system in Pakistan, which the Pakistani state has had to cover. And estimates I've seen from the World Bank indicate that those deficits might be as high as $2 billion per year. There's no investment or very little investment in existing infrastructure in Pakistan. There increasingly are large losses in output, and it's been suggested by some development bankers I've spoken to about this issue in the last several weeks that the amount of revenue that the electricity suppliers in Pakistan are losing per kilowatt hour is probably an amount which is equal to the price of the kilowatt hour itself. So this is how serious the problem is, and has suggested to some critics that building the reactors, adding 650 megawatt to the Pakistani grid by sometime after 2016, 2017, 2018, that is not going to alleviate the immediate situation on the ground in Pakistan. So the bottom line on this is NSG has an umbilical cord relationship with the NSG, with the NPT. All NSG parties are now in the treaty, and this is a dilemma where the NSG sits right now. It should be pointed out, to be absolutely clear, that without the U.S.-Indian deal, we wouldn't have this problem right now. The Chinese have been pressed by Pakistan, at least since 2005, to supply more reactors. And until now, the Chinese have, in fact, exercised considerable restraint. I discussed this issue with people in Islamabad several years ago, and at the time, what we heard was that the Pakistan government had pressed the Chinese to supply the reactors, but at the time, the Chinese were not willing to do it, in large part because the Chinese were not satisfied that the U.S.-India deal was going to go through. It wasn't sure it would be approved by the Congress, by the Indian Parliament, whether a safeguards agreement with the IEA would be approved, whether the NSG would approve it. And in a sense, without the approval of the U.S.-India deal, the Chinese were sitting on the fence. So, you know, now we've got the Indian deal in place. The Chinese, in the view of NSG parties, feel strongly that, you know, China can now, you know, enter into the breach that's been opened up by the Indian deal and move on this at this particular time. They also realize that the United States government has a lot on its plate with China, that this would be an opportune time for China to press ahead with this. At the same time, as I said, you know, 1 month ago, that RevCon final document speaks for 189 countries in the NSG, and it basically said, look, the Indian deal was an exception. Underscoring that, when Iran's president spoke on the initial day of the NPT RevCon in New York, he basically said, you know, why should non-nuclear weapon states in the treaty stay in the treaty if weapon states who are outside the NPT get a better deal? And this is, you know, the, if you will, the sort of Damocles that hangs over the over this whole issue. As I also said, you know, the NAM is arising. In the last several years, a chapter of the NAM has been started in Vienna. The NAM in nuclear supply issues is becoming much more active. There's a certain spillover into the NSG. The Turkish position, in the view of some people who were close to that meeting, basically said that it sounded like Iranian talking points. And the bottom line in this exercise will be, when push comes to shove, where will the priorities be in this? Is the priority going to be in satisfying the principles that were expressed by 189 countries in the NPT? Or is it going to be a package deal that is going to be arranged or an accommodation to China and Pakistan to meet essentially existential security threats in Afghanistan and Pakistan? There are people who have argued that there should be a Pakistan NSG accommodation. Some of these people, you know, Chris Fair, who's now in South Waziristan, she has communicated to me that she still basically believes this. People in the U.S. government have discussed it. It doesn't seem to be, you know, getting traction in the U.S. But, you know, the question is whether the U.S. government would accommodate this for reasons that don't have to do with nonproliferation, reflecting the decision that it took in 2008 to accommodate India for reasons that likewise did not have anything to do with nonproliferation. And in the deep background of it, of course, is a question as to whether or not the NSG, the NPT parties, stakeholders in the security dialogue in South Asia are going to say it's time, after the Indian deal, now that we've broken that taboo, to look at Pakistan within, you know, the broader architecture of the nonproliferation regime and the security problems that we have in the region, and try to craft a new nuclear order that would include all of the outlier states. I haven't heard anyone discuss that or make any linkages to this question, either regarding the guideline issue or the China-Pakistan issue, but on the margins of this, there is a discussion about how that would happen, how that could happen. I have argued that one way to look at China and Pakistan and the NSG would be to press China if it looked as if China would, in any event, insist on going through this commerce, to create a non-proliferation and nuclear security benefit which might head off resistance and resentment in the NSG group while solving security problems in Southeast Asia, tying China in a more direct way than the U.S. has done so far into nonproliferation and nuclear security issues in South Asia. It would also be in China's interest because China, like the United States, is concerned about nuclear terrorism in Pakistan. It realizes that loose nukes in Pakistan could be targeted at China. So this is an option. Some people, including Chris Fair, have suggested that if something happens in this along this line, one might somehow try to get a firmer commitment by Pakistan on terrorism. My colleague Pierre Goldschmidt has proposed a number of other possibilities, including the nuclear conventions and convents that you see here. And in any event, NSG parties who are looking at this exemption or grandfather possibility, NSG parties, I think, would want to make sure that if the deal would be grandfathered or exempted, that there would be a clear limitation on the scope of the nuclear commerce that China would be permitted under that agreement to engage in Pakistan. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. There's clearly a lot to talk about there, so I'm going to hold off on any questions I might have, and let's open it up, and I may jump in at some point. Please raise your hand. Someone will come to you with a microphone, and then identify yourself. Let's start in the back there, Keith.
Paul Kerr from the Congressional Research Service. Mark, I was wondering if you could clarify, because I didn't understand this fully the first time, why it is that the United States is opposed to grandfathering regarding the Pakistan agreement.
Apparently China in 2004, when it joined the NSG, it said it was going to go through with Chasma 2, the power reactor which it wanted to supply to Pakistan after it had supplied the Chasma 1 reactor. The NSG parties asked China, well, look, if you're going to join the NSG, the guidelines say no more commerce with states that are outside, the NPT or don't have a CSA. And the Chinese said, well, we have this deal with Pakistan, and it predates our joining the treaty, and we're going to grandfather it. And the NSG parties asked the Chinese at the time, what was then the scope of that bilateral Sino-Pakistan cooperation deal? And what you hear from NSG people is the Chinese said, well, maybe we're going to Chasma 2, we're going to do maybe some research reactors and the fuel in perpetuity for all of these reactors. And at the time, the Chinese didn't talk about any further power reactors for this. So Chasma 3 and 4 were not on the table, and on that basis, the U.S. says, well, you didn't mention Chasma 3 or 4 then, so it's outside of the scope of your agreement with Pakistan, and you can't grandfather it. I think, behind the scenes of this, or in the psychology of the U.S. position, may also be the experience that the United States had with Russia in 2001, I think, and then again later 2005 or so, when Russia wanted to export power reactors under an agreement that it had previously contracted with India of a similar nature. I know for a fact that U.S. government officials asked their Russian counterparts to provide, in fact, documentary evidence that there was an agreement with India that included more power reactors to India, and the Russians didn't provide anything. The U.S. was not happy about this, and then the second part of it was that the Russians later on then argued that on safety grounds, invoking an exception clause in the NSG, on safety grounds, Russia could supply uranium fuel for the Tarpor reactors that likewise, you know, did not please the United States. So the whole issue of grandfathering is a very sensitive matter to the U.S. So they're kind of allergic to it to begin with, and so their position is informed by this. So that's the reason I think that the United States doesn't want to go that route.
Jessica Matthews, Carnegie. Mark, one slide says on Pakistan's electric sector, oil, gas, hydro, nuclear, I read it as together equal less than 3%.
Oh, sorry. No. Most of it is fuel oil, natural gas, and hydro. That's practically all of it. The nuclear share is 3%. That's it. They got a couple of reactors online. It's about 2.5% of the whole generation.
Okay.
Sorry.
And then talk a little bit about the 30% output loss. If that's 30% of 20,000 megawatts, it's 10 times the size of the sale. Have we looked at what the investment is to correct it, et cetera?
Well, Jessica, I don't think it would be 30% of 20,000 because I believe that the capacity factor for the Pakistani electricity supply system is very low. I'm only guessing, you know, there may be people in this room who have a better idea of what's going on the ground in Pakistan. I would be surprised if the total capacity that's in use right now would be any more than between 13 and 15,000 megawatt. It may be, in fact, considerably less than that. So all across the board, they have major, you know, inefficiencies in the system that lead some people to believe that the way to go in Pakistan to address their problems is by a series, you know, of programs and measures that wouldn't have anything to do with building nuclear reactors.
Or any capacity.
Well, they might. You know, there's a possibility that, you know, there hasn't been any capacity built. I mean, it must be said that for the last decade there hasn't been any new capacity, and it would be logical that Pakistan, in trying to meet a power demand growth of 7-8% per year, would certainly schedule and budget additional capacity building, but it hasn't happened. And, you know, a lot of people basically said it doesn't have to be nuclear. And it would be, you know, bringing non-nuclear sources of supply on in Pakistan would be a quicker solution than building a reactor.
But has the World Bank or anybody actually done a serious look at what it would cost and to remove some of the current output losses?
That's a good question. I don't know. The World Bank, to my knowledge, has a fairly piecemeal approach to this. They're aware of the problem in Pakistan. If you look at their documents, they're clearly very well informed about the whole situation. I don't know if there's been a country study that has drawn conclusions about what the total investment package would be.
Economic problem. I mean, you have the polity and the parliament controlled by people who don't want to pay for electricity, who also don't pay taxes, and have no interest whatsoever in changing any of that. So if the Chinese or somebody want to come and build a plant, they'll steal that electricity too. But nobody there would invest in a power plant because you're not going to get paid. And part of the shortage now is the fuel suppliers, because burn oil, aren't getting paid.
So they have
plants that aren't operating because people who supply the fuel aren't getting paid. So they say, fine, we're not going to get paid. And meanwhile, the mill operators and the agricultural interests take the electricity without paying for it.
The producers are producing and selling electricity at a loss of $2 billion a year because the cost, you know, the price of electricity is so cheap that there's no relationship between the cost of electricity to the consumer and or the price of electricity to the consumer and the cost of electricity to the producers and distributors.
You, sir, and then in the back.
Thank you very much, Raghubir Goyal from India Global Asia Today. My question is that both nations, China and Pakistan, are rogue nations in many ways, like supporting terrorism and also lack of human rights. Question is that, do you think that this deal could have or would have gone without the knowledge of U.S. officials, because since Pakistan is a most trusted and close ally of the United States and most of the aid flows to Pakistan and maybe much of the aid will be used from USA to this deal. And also...
I'm sorry, which deal?
The
Chinese-Pakistan nuclear deal. And finally, do you believe that there will be a competition or nuclear race between India and Pakistan because of this deal in the future?
Well, you know, I don't think that, you know, the United States doesn't really factor into whether or not China would export a reactor to Pakistan. The United States doesn't have any real options. As I said, the NSG guidelines themselves are voluntary. The United States is, you know, has a lot of issues with China right now, and there's nothing that the United States could do to prevent China from going through with this deal. There's no relationship there. Regarding your second question, I don't see the supply of power reactors to Pakistan as playing any serious role or any, having any serious effect on the security balance between Pakistan and India. I think with the Indian deal, you could make the argument cogently that there was a connection. Pakistan has eloquently made that at the CD earlier this year, that, in fact, the Indian deal has essentially freed up uranium that could be used for its nuclear weapons program. I think in the case of Pakistan and the Chinese reactors, I see this is an additive program. I don't see any serious or major impact on Pakistan's defense situation vis-a-vis India coming out of a deal like this.
Yes, in the back. You need the microphone. Thank you.
Stephen Dolly with Platts. Well, Mark just answered the question I was going to ask about diplomatic leverage, so let me broaden it out a little bit. If this does go through and the Chinese-Pakistan nuclear deal, what is the future prospect of the NSG as a way of if not controlling exports, then at least regulating to some degree? Is there any way to staunch the bleeding or save it, or will it just be a case of we don't export to non-NPT members except when we do?
Well, I think it should be pointed out to begin with, which I didn't do before, that NSG does a lot of things. NSG doesn't spend most of its time dealing with commerce to outlier states. It spends most of the time, you know, looking at all kinds of nuclear transactions involving, you know, 189 NPT parties. This is a very small, tiny fraction of what the NSG does. That being said, you're correct in pointing out that if this commerce takes place, the NSG is going to have a case of heartburn to deal with, because it gave in on the Indian deal. Now we have Pakistan, and, you know, we have 189 countries in the NPT, which, you know, got their back up in May. You've got to understand that during the negotiation of the RevCom, it looked as if, in the view of some people that were watching that negotiation, that the supplier states might waver and you know, temporize on the paragraph 12 from the extension decision, which basically mandated CSA. And that didn't happen in part because of the extremely strong reaction by NAM states and other non-nuclear weapon states in the NPT during that negotiation, which wanted to make absolutely clear in a final document that the U.S.-India deal is an exception. And now you know, they basically put the NSG on notice that if they permit an exception to Pakistan, you know, there could be hell to pay. And that's what President Ahmadinejad, you know, basically was referring to in his opening statement when he talked about commerce from, you know, NPT states to weapon states outside the treaty. You know, this is a potentially explosive issue. The question is, you know, does that play out in having a bunch of NPT countries leave the NPT because of this? I don't think so. But it would certainly increase the motivation of some of these countries to push the edge of the envelope inside the NPT and want to have capabilities that would put them on the brink of a nuclear weapons capability, maybe very similar to what we've seen in Iran. You know, you got to understand that in 2004, the Bush administration basically started this issue in the view of some critics, created the problem by telling the world that the U.S. wanted to ban the further transfer of this technology to states outside of a small group or cartel of technology holders. And until then, you know, there wasn't really any push by, you know, non-nuclear weapon states inside the treaty to get that technology. But the fact that, you know, the Bush people were talking about banning it certainly, you know, set alarm bells off in certain countries that were becoming very interested in having nuclear energy and were concerned about possible political supply interruptions. Others had a certain suite of technologies which they'd already developed. Others had market opportunities like Canada, which had a definite rationale for doing uranium enrichment, had very strong non-proliferation bona fides. These countries, you know, said, you know, wait a minute, you know, you're telling us we can't enrich, we can't get access to the technology, you know, and they started making objections. And, you know, now if the Pakistan deal goes through, it's perfectly likely that the non-nuclear weapon states, which don't have the technology, will say, okay, you know, to bring it full circle and back to the ENR discussion, you know, we're cutting it off right now in terms of tighter controls. We will not accept any further restrictions on any nuclear technology transfers. And this is, you know, on the periphery going to cause the NSG heartburn in other areas. For example, if you look at one of the things the NSG is doing, including it was discussed during this meeting last week, is its outreach program to universalize the guidelines. And one of the areas, you know, that they're working on the outreach program is with uranium suppliers that are in the NPT but are totally outside of the world of the NSG. These are countries which are now supplying uranium. The uranium price has increased in several recent years. There's a lot of prospecting going on. There's going to be probably in the future, if the uranium price continues to escalate or increase, there will be a raft of new uranium providers in the world, and the NSG people very much want to have those countries on board. And in this context, if the non-nuclear weapon states in the treaty say, we don't want to see any more controls, you know, there is going to be some pushback, and some of these countries which are, you know, in the NOM, think of a country like Niger, for example, Namibia, other African states, some states in Central Asia, are going to be, you know, asked by the supplier states to restrain themselves and in their conduct, and it's going to be a very difficult case to make if the NSG starts making exceptions.
I just want to add, and I'll take this point in back, but I'm just building on what Mark said, and if you look at the totality of the issues, whether it's China, Pakistan, the question about managing enrichment reprocessing, Turkey's view, and then if you add to that the recent discussions where Turkey and Brazil engage with Iran to try to work out the fuel arrangement for the Tehran Research Reactor, I mean, it's really apparent that we kind of have a reordering of the nuclear order, as it were, and new players asserting themselves in what is not a really structured discussion or arena about what are going to be the terms of the rules going forward. In a lot of ways, the India deal, this is one of its most horrendous unintentional consequences, I think, it opened up a lot of stuff for debate and discussion and allowed people to imagine a different way of doing things based just on volition. That if you had a certain amount of clout and you wanted to do something differently, you could actually go in there and make it happen. And so you're alluding to this with China. With China's, if they want to sell to Pakistan, they'll be able to use muscle to get other people to go along. But Turkey and Brazil are now saying, okay, we've got muscle too, and we want to show the muscle. And so they're doing that, and they're doing that with Iran, and they're doing it in these discussions, and basically looking back and saying, okay, what are you going to do about it? And the answer is not much. And then that has another effect on other people who say, okay, if you muscle up, you can kind of do what you want. And Brazil's sitting there saying, well, we have an enrichment program that they have. They say they invented the technology and that they could sell it if they want to. So in a sense, you could also imagine a Brazil doing deals with Iran and others to supply enrichment and working around it. So I guess the question is, it's a question, which is, like, how do states, like, step back from all of that and say, okay, time out, how do we put some new structure in that can be sustainable, and kind of on what terms or whose terms? I mean, is there a way to kind of renegotiate and reset, as it were, or is this just going to keep kind of tumbling along with exceptions?
I think obviously one of the problems is that in this context it looks as if the task is equivalent to squaring the circle, because the NPT parties have set down these lines in the sand, and the NSG is looking at these other issues and they're saying, you know, what are we going to do? The Chinese are going to arm twist us. Pakistan and Afghanistan are crying out for solutions. These are overriding issues that don't have anything to do with the geeky details of a safeguards agreement or the NPT, but have to do with real world problems. And you know, we're going to have to deal with this. And then there's a certain amount of anticipation about what happens to NPT states if the rules of the game are not applied. And you know, nobody knows the answers to this, but the possibility that it could fly off the handle is considerable, because the Iranians have, in the last several years, have gotten a certain amount of respect in the street for behaving the way they have. I mean, obviously in New York, the Iranians overplayed their hand. You know, they were isolated in the end. The NAM states told Iran, you know, we're not going to let you hijack this conference. You know, we're going to make this deal. And Iran, you know, crossed the line with NAM. But it would be a mistake to assume that on major political issues like this that get traction in NAM governments, that the fact that Iran was isolated at the NPT meeting because the Iranians made a tactical miscalculation, we should not conclude from that there's not going to be some rapport on this existential issue between Iran and the NAM in maybe another context when it has to do with, you know, states outside the treaty, you know, getting access to trade that they can't get. And you're going to see, you know, a regeneration of, you know, a stronger relationship between Iran and the NAM on these issues.
In the back, and then next.
Yeah. Mohammed Atif for the BOA. My question is a two-part question. If U.S. and China can bring Pakistan and India in NPT, do you think it is going to control the damage of NSG and control the damage on its effectiveness? And second, if China goes through, which looks like it's going to go through, do you think any kind of international oversight is required?
Well, your second question has a fairly simple answer. The reactors that China would supply to Pakistan in this case, as in previous cases, would be under IAEA safeguards. There's no question that they would be unsafeguarded. I think some of the discussion about a deal with China and Pakistan through the NSG, some of the discussion gets into more greater levels of oversight in actions that Pakistan and China would take to improve, you know, physical protection, nuclear security, other things which you can consider international oversight, if you will, in the most umbrella sense of that term. But I don't think the oversight issue here is too significant. Could you repeat your first question?
Yeah, it was about bringing Pakistan and India and NPT.
Oh, well, that's not going to happen. You know, both of them are de facto weapon states. They've made very clear to everybody that NPT membership is not on the table. If there's going to be an accommodation in the region, it's going to be outside of the NPT. And you know, anybody who thinks that either of those countries will join the NPT basically lives on a different planet than the rest of us do.
Seema Sirohia, I'm an Indian journalist. First, a small comment and then a question. The India deal, in your opinion, opened up this whole problem, but India also had to go through many hoops and, you know, separate its military and civilian nuclear program, undergo all kinds of what India considers rather intrusive conditions. So at the very least, shouldn't Pakistan have to go through that? It seems to me that you all are just accepting it, that it's going to happen and there's no way to stop it. The non-proliferation community in Washington before the Indo-US deal was up in arms and did, you know, everything to sort of to oppose it. My question is, when you say that China should be tied more directly into some sort of non-proliferation South Asian structure, could you elaborate on that? Because for India, that would be a non-starter to give China any kind of supervisory role.
Well, one place to look for an answer there would be in the latest publication of Securing the Bomb from the Belfer Center at Harvard, which talks in one or two pages in that book about nuclear security issues in Pakistan and what has to be done there. And there's a raft of things that could be done, including assistance from the United States, from China, to improve the security of assets in Pakistan. Let me point out that one of the reasons that I suggested that as a possible option is because in recent years, as you know, Pakistan has become almost existentially allergic to interactions with the United States having to do with the security of nuclear weapons and nuclear assets in Pakistan. And I submit that, you know, China has had a far greater level of cooperation and interaction with Pakistan over the years, allowing China to perhaps get past some of the existential angst, if you will, that the Pakistanis are feeling vis-a-vis Washington on some of these security issues. It would be easier, perhaps, for Pakistan to cooperate with China. The other side of the fence, it might be possible for the United States to accommodate this because, as you recall, since the early 80s, the United States and China have been in a great deal of interaction and cooperation and dialogue and debate about the future of nuclear cooperation between China and the U.S., and the two countries had to work through a lot of nonproliferation problems, including issues concerning China's exports of nuclear technology to Pakistan, including for its nuclear weapons program. So, you know, the U.S. and China have been over this ground. They've worked out a way to interact. There is, you know, a way for China and the United States to solve these issues and discuss them. And it would be possible, perhaps, for the United States to work with China and Pakistan, and, you know, to this end. To get back to the point you raised about the Indian deal, I submit that India might not like the idea that, that China would interact with Pakistan in this way, but, you know, I also, you know, submit that India knew in 2005 when the deal was proposed, the bilateral U.S.-India deal was proposed, the Indians were aware, certainly, that for the United States, the Indian deal was not about nuclear energy. It was about reorienting America's global relationships, you know, and its strategic rebalancing, if you will, its relationship with China and India in the world. And the Indians certainly knew that. For the Indians, the nuclear deal was an opportunity. And for the U.S., it had to do with, you know, strategic matters. And the Indians knew that, and they went ahead with it, understanding that that Indian deal would be considered by Beijing to be a challenge. So, you know, the biggest problem for India would have been, you know, dealing with that and not dealing with, you know, a modicum of additional cooperation between China and India, I'm sorry, China and Pakistan in a nuclear area. I do, you know, acknowledge, of course, that there would be questions that would be raised by the U.S. and others about, you know, the nature of the cooperation between China and Pakistan. And, you know, there would be some kind of mechanism which would have to be put in place to assure other countries in the NSG and also India that the Chinese cooperation with Pakistan in this area would not spill over into additional aid for its nuclear weapons program.
I want to add a little to that, because I agree with what Mark said, and he was probably more diplomatic than I'll be. But the and I also think it's a bad idea for anybody to be supplying Pakistan with more reactors for the economic and other reasons there that doesn't it'll take a long time. It'll cost way more money than people think. You could take that money and time and provide more electricity to Pakistanis, you know, sooner with none of the side effects. So, but like Mark said, look, this was totally predictable. It wouldn't be happening at all if there weren't the U.S.-India deal. And when that deal were proposed, the first thing many of us said to the people in Washington who proposed it in India was, you do know that China's going to get even, right? And then the response was, we'll use our power to block it, which was a total delusion, but reflected a certain mindset of the Bush administration. And they were precisely not interested in nonproliferation. So India didn't accept CTBT, fissile material cutoff, or any other nonproliferation step that would have been serious that now you'd want with Pakistan. Well, right. Shouldn't have thought of that earlier, number one. Number two, China, because of the way the NSG went, China had to go along with it, which was actually very interesting. So the U.S. used kind of realpolitik, and India used realpolitik with the Chinese, and the Chinese kind of went along. It's pretty good sports because they could have blocked it. And if they would have blocked it, India would have said, this is outrageous, and I thought we were improving our relationship, and we have improved ties with China and dialogue and everything else. How are you blocking us? Well, okay. They didn't block it. But that's all part of getting even, too, which is now when they want to propose something, the idea that somehow the U.S. is going to block it, and other states are going to block, and the Chinese say, hey, we were good sports when you wanted to do it, and you wanted to do it explicitly to balance our power. So it was directed against us, and we didn't block it. And now we're talking about supplying your non-NATO ally, who's a friend of yours, and we're asking you for basically the same decency and sportsmanship that you get. How's the U.S. going to say no to that? All right? And moreover, the terms of the India deal are much worse. India's buying fuel, which would enable it then to substitute other fuel and produce new nuclear weapons. There's nothing about what's being talked about in the building two reactors in Pakistan that would add in any way to Pakistan's nuclear weapons production capability. Again, I'm not for the deal, but I'm just saying the terms of it. And then you say rightly, well, India separated the civilian and military components. But there was a big surprise that India took 8 reactors that everybody thought were civilian reactors and said, these are military. How is that a gain from a global standpoint? India has a breeder program, could produce a lot of nuclear weapon material. And under the deal, India says, guess what? That's not a civilian program. We always said it was. It's not. It's military. So if you kind of want to compare, in a sense, the kind of proliferation and military a balance between these two things, it's not even close in terms of what would be proposed here. And again, I don't think it's a good idea, but compared to the India deal, it's trivial in terms of its impact and contribution to potential military competition there. And so I think it's understandable India's going to object to it, but it's, I think a lot of the rest of the world's kind of looking at it and laughing and saying, well, you know, how do you think we felt? It's taken 5 years, but people get even when you try to screw them. And so that's what happened. I should have to give you an opportunity to respond, and then we'll work our way around the room. We'll take you respond, Seema, and then we'll work around that table.
No, I just wanted to say that at the NSG, the Chinese were hardly cooperative. You remember that till the very last meeting, you know, they had to be locked up by the U.S. to make the deal go through. They were not cooperative. We should remember that.
They went along with it. They let it happen.
They didn't technically block it, but they did everything till the very last moment.
Well, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is that they signed on to it.
That's diplomacy. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Mr. Lloyd from the University of Maryland. We all know for sure that New Zealand is in the southern hemisphere, and it's one of the most beautiful environmental biodiversity on Earth. It's one of our last corners, so we can say it is truly paradise with its great plant and animal collection, biodiversity in all forms. Environment is really very good with all these mountains and lakes, and really a beautiful place to live. Now, in the name of our nuclear ambitions and global trade, and with all of the corners of the world polluted with all kinds of nuclear stuff, can we afford, you know, as ordinary people, can we afford that even this one last single corner of the world be polluted in the name of trade and in our environmental and our nuclear ambitions? Any thoughts on this? Thank you.
Dan, and because I just want to make sure we're done by 10:30. So, Dan, go ahead.
Hi, Dan Horner from Arms Control Today. I wanted to get back to the question of this particular deal and the U.S. reaction. Mark alluded to the U.S. comments in the run-up to the NSG meeting. And I thought those comments were interesting because they were more, I guess, vigorous than I would have thought. They could have very easily said at that point, you know, we're still considering this, blah, and that's in fact what public officials had said in their few comments on it. So I was wondering, how did you interpret that rather firm response? Was that an attempt to scuttle the kind of grand bargain that you're talking about, or just how are you reading that in the dynamics in the U.S. government? Thanks.
All right. Let me talk to Dan's question first. I'll admit I was rather surprised by the degree to which the United States was willing to tip its hand in advance of the meeting. You know, we've known for a long time that the U.S. had, you know, these belly aches about the grandfathering in Russia. The U.S. government
raised it directly at the NSG meeting with the Chinese in 2004. So, you know, clearly they were, you know, they were ticked off about it. They, you know, they didn't like it. So getting the Chinese to grandfather clearly, you know, would be maybe for a lot of people in D.C., it would be a non-starter. They don't like it. But it's one thing to say you don't want to see a grandfathering of the deal by China. It's another thing to say we want to see China, as the U.S. government people did say, that we want to see China seek an exemption. You know, that was indeed striking, Dan. I agree. And I haven't – I don't really have a simple answer for it. I don't know what it is. There's been a certain amount of speculation about it. I can tell you that even people that watch the NSG closely were suggesting, you know, this might mean, you know, the United States is trying to set up China because, you know, they know that were China to seek an exemption, they wouldn't get it. You know, I had when I was in China in March, I was there at a time when a number of NSG European states were having bilaterals with the Chinese, and I had some meetings with some of those European states when I was in Beijing surrounding their discussions with the Chinese, and they told me clearly that in their view, this was March, in their meeting with the Chinese, they told China, they told their Chinese counterparts that China wouldn't get an exemption. That, you know, the NSG, especially depending on how the REVCON plays out, there's no mood in the NSG to give China an exemption for any more trade. So it might have been the case that the U.S. government, when it crafted this position, anticipated that the NSG parties, which, by the way, include, you know, a bunch of white angel states, including New Zealand, to get back to the other gentleman's question, who, you know, were arm-twisted by India, the U.S., France, and Russia in 2008, and they don't want to see that happen again. And these countries, you know, are, you know, not going to want to agree to a deal giving China an exemption. And it may have been the U.S. position that they just basically felt that if we get China to go this road, down this road, China will not succeed and we'll solve the problem by that, you know, in that way. That might have been the calculus. So to be fair, no one in the U.S. government has told me that, and I don't really know that that's true. But I did have these interactions with the smaller Euro states in Beijing, and that was clearly the impression that I had about what they were expecting. As far as New Zealand goes, I mean, New Zealand was a country which was, in fact, rolled by India during the 2008 deliberation. New Zealand is a country in the White Angel Group which has very, very strong non-proliferation bona fides, and the statements that the New Zealand government have made, you know, are time-honored and are reiterated again and again, including in the NSG. And, you know, the New Zealanders have the bitter experience of having the Indians, in the advent of the decision by the NSG in 2008 to provide India an exception, India muscled in on New Zealand and put its entire trade relationship with that country on the line. And, you know, New Zealand, I can tell you that Madam Ambassador probably was not very happy about anticipating the possibility that they would face a decision to make by NSG about giving China an exemption for trade to Pakistan.
Actually, I had promised Alan Weir, who's a New Zealander, Kiwi. So I'll give him the last question, Alan, and we'll wrap up. I didn't mean to forget coming back this way.
Thanks, George. Alan Weir from Parliamentarians for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament from New Zealand. You were talking a little bit about Pakistan's electricity needs as one of the stimuluses for the nuclear energy program and developing that further. Similarly, in the developing countries, non-aligned countries,
the increasing electricity needs are part of the stimulus for more of them being interested in the nuclear energy programs, and are part of resisting the greater controls as part of you ensuring a secure supply for that. But George, you were saying, you know, that in reality, the nuclear energy would be very difficult in fulfilling some of these needs, particularly in the short term, because it takes so long to build a nuclear power plant. There's also problems loading an already overtaxed grid with, you know, a very centralized energy source, when in the developing countries, in particular, to reach those without electricity, it's probably better to go for some of these small-scale renewable energy technologies, which can actually reach the villages which might not be on the energy grid. The difficulty, though, is that with nuclear energy, there is a lot of international assistance, particularly through advice and assistance from the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as from the corporations and the countries involved in that. On the development of renewable energies, there's not quite so much assistance, so there is now the new International Renewable Energy Agency. What sort of, in terms of trying to provide some carrots, not just restrictions, when you're trying to put in restrictions on the nuclear energy, is there any capacity for the International Atomic Energy Agency or the Nuclear Suppliers Group to work a little bit more in conjunction with the International Renewable Energy Agency to assist the developing countries in developing the energy needs, sources that would be appropriate for their you know, particular energy grids and capacities, rather than going for the nuclear energy, which might not be suitable for them? Thank you.
Well, the NSG... it represents the interests of nuclear supplier states, and it's totally unconnected to the Renewable Energy Agency, as well as the IEA is likewise not connected. George probably might have something to say about the other things that your question addresses regarding the security dialogue that's going on between the United States and Pakistan, because the U.S., you know, has told Pakistan in the context of that security dialogue they don't want to do a nuclear deal with Pakistan, but they are sensitive to Pakistan's needs in the energy supply and demand area, and the U.S., you know, is working with Pakistan on non-nuclear energy issues.
I mean, but there's a big issue here, which is some of the attraction of nuclear is status, symbolism, its prowess, and so on and so forth. It has nothing to do with supplying energy to people or economics. So that doesn't fit. The U.S. is interested and should be interested in supplying electricity to Pakistan, but all of the issues I talked about earlier in terms of pricing, corruption, and everything else are there. And I will tell you, I was in Pakistan, this is like 8 years ago, working on this, going around and talking to people about renewable energy, because so much of the population is away from a grid. And it was explained to me why the government of Pakistan, why there wasn't more of these projects in Pakistan. And the guy said, the invoices are too small, meaning you can't steal money from village-level renewable energy projects, but big centralized electricity they'll support because you steal the money off the contracts. And so he said, as long as the contracts are small, we'll never do it. So again, that's not a technology problem. It's not an NSG problem. It's a governance problem. It's an internal problem. On that happy note, we can go out to our own healthy polity to see what today's news is bringing. I want to thank Mark in particular. I want to thank all of you for coming out this morning, and we'll do this again. Thanks a lot.